This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us in the studio Jim Jones from Seattle. For 25 years, Jim Jones taught American literature at Missouri State University. During that time, he published 6 scholarly books, including 4 on the life and writing of Jack Kerouac. He also operated his own small poetry press. After retiring to Seattle in 2006, he learned letterpress printing, and he now specializes in printing poetry postcards featuring mostly Northwest poets. His most recent book is Dear Carolyn, a collection of letters from the wife of beat icon Neal Cassady. He is married to the poet Sharon Cumberland. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks, Sheila. It's great to be here.
I'm happy to have you here. I know you have connections to Port Townsend through friends and poets. I'm glad you had the time to come to the studio. And of course, I'm happy to tell our listeners that the way I know you is through the poet Sharon Cumberland. She's a longtime poetry friend of mine, and I've taught at the same institution once in a while where she's been a tenured professor for years. I'm wondering how we can talk about your presence here as a person who publishes these poetry postcards, and then maybe backtrack through your history of teaching and knowing the beats and writing about them and all of that.
Yeah, that'll only cover about 50 years.
All right, well, then you'll have to come back to cover the next, I don't know how many.
50 more.
All right, I hope we get that.
Since I was an undergraduate, I've always been engaged in the poetry scene wherever I was. So when I went to school in East Central Illinois, and I was studying literature and working for the local newspaper, and I immediately got interested in writing poetry. And I always thought I would be a poet. In fact, on my first academic job interview, my first full-time teaching job, the dean asked me what my goal in life was. I blurted out without thinking about where I really was. I said, oh, I want to be a poet. But I just don't have the right kind of discipline to be a poet. I've got discipline in other ways.
Did you get that job?
I did get the job, too.
All right.
By a series of flukes, I ended up staying there for several years.
What do you think the difference is, then, between the kind of discipline you have? You've produced all of these books and postcards, and what a poet needs.
I don't like editors.
Oh.
Too much of my ego's wrapped up in my writing, and I don't like people to mess with it.
Do you write poems and just not show them to editors?
I published a little bit at the beginning of my career for the first 10 years or so, and I've published poems in magazines that I've edited. And I also publish some of my own poetry on postcards once in a great while.
That's good to know, because it's always good to reach our goals, right?
Right. And there's no easier way than to publish yourself.
Right. So poetry's always been a part of your life. And I know from a previous discussion that you actually worked for Allen Ginsberg.
I did. As I told you before, I was writing about a new critic and minor poet named R.P. Blackmuir, who taught at Princeton for many years and had many famous students like W.S. Merwin. The place I was teaching, Missouri State, one of my colleagues, a good friend of mine, Linda Park Fuller, was a theater professor, and she mounted a production of a play about the Beat Generation that was just a bunch of texts that were cobbled together. She asked me to review it and talk to her student actors about the Beat Generation. And I did, and I really enjoyed the play, and it sort of reminded me how rich the whole Beat era was. After this critique session, she said to me, why don't you write about the Beats instead of what you're writing about? Well, New Criticism in 1980 was a melting iceberg. And so I thought, I better get off of this one and get on something more stable. And the Beats turned out to be very stable, very popular over the course of many decades.
So just for our listeners who might not know all of the Beat poets, can you name them?
The main three writers were Allen Ginsberg, a poet, Jack Kerouac, a novelist, and William S. Burroughs, a kind of experimental novelist. And there were others. The fourth, probably most famous one, is Gregory Corso, the poet. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who runs a famous bookstore in San Francisco called City Lights. And Lawrence is still alive. The others are all dead. There are still some minor Beats that are still alive. Gary Snyder is often considered a Beat poet because he and Kerouac were friends, and he figures in one of Kerouac's novels prominently. There are other ones, but those are the main ones.
Right. Thank you. Anne Waldman was among them.
Anne Waldman is usually considered to be part of the second generation New York school poets. When Allen founded the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa Institute in 1971, he asked Anne to come and be the director of it. The way I met Allen was after I decided to start writing about the Beats, it occurred to me to write a book about Kerouac's poetry because nobody had done that before. And so I actually wrote this book about Kerouac's book-length poem, Mexico City Blues. And when I was working on it, at the same time I got this idea, there was a big Beats conference in Lawrence, Kansas, where the University of Kansas is, which is where William S. Burroughs was living at the time. And he was getting very old and he had heart problems. And so his partner, James Grauerholtz, decided he would have a conference and bring all of the living Beats there to celebrate William's life. And I decided that I was going to teach a course in the Beats, and it all came together. So I took a bunch of my students there. This was in the fall of 87, I think. And I met Anne Waldman, and I met Ed Sanders, and I met a bunch of people. And Allen was there, of course. And I was talking to Anne Waldman, and I told her about this plan to write about Kerouac's poetry. And she said, well, you should really come to Naropa and spend the summer there. And so I said, sure, fine, I'll do it. I applied for a summer fellowship from my university, so they paid my way to go to Boulder. And when I got there, we had a meeting of the people who were considered teaching assistants. Anne was giving out assignments, and she said, well, I'm going to have you work with Allen because Allen is the one who can help you most with Kerouac's poetry. And so another guy, Steve Creason, who's still a really good friend of mine today, and I shared the duties of being Allen's chauffeur and gopher and confidant for 6 weeks. And then I went back the next summer and did the same thing again.
Did he help you with Kerouac's poetry?
He did help me a lot to understand it. I met Gregory Corso that same summer. I met William S. Burroughs. I met Harry Smith, the filmmaker, who's actually from the Northwest. I met a lot of the living Beats. And so I got more than just direct help. I got sort of immersed into this whole
Gestalt
scene. And I also met Steve, whose book I ended up publishing later, one of whose books I ended up publishing. Another guy, Andy Hoffman, who is one of my publishers. So Andy published my latest book all through the Naropa, kind of the extended Beat, second generation New York school poetry.
So you have quite a lot that you owe the professor, the drama professor. And I love it when people use their intuition and give somebody some good advice. And
yeah.
That's great.
That was the best advice because I'll tell you what, Beat conferences were a lot more interesting than most academic conferences.
A lot
more interesting.
I want to give the full title of the book that you wrote about Jack Kerouac as a poet, A Map of Mexico City Blues, Jack Kerouac as a Poet by James T. Jones. Is this still available?
Yeah, it's from Southern Illinois University Press, which is where I went to graduate school.
And then there's an interesting story then about the link between that book and your latest book, Dear Carolyn, Letters from Carolyn Cassidy to Jim Jones.
Right. Well, it's actually a link between this book and
book. Okay, so there's another book about Jack Kerouac called Jack Kerouac's Forgotten Families, Use My Name. And what's interesting here is you have changed your other name from James T. to Jim Jones.
Someone who reviewed that book criticized me for having two names, but I use my full name for my academic books, and then I intended this book, this Use My Name, to be a crossover. I thought, I've written enough academic books, I should try to make some money now. And I thought, this will do it because Kerouac is popular. This is kind of an unusual view of Kerouac's life. It's not the typical legendizing view of the Beats. And so I found a publisher in Canada who would make a mass market paperback. Well, it flopped.
Oh.
But about 5 years after this came out, I got a letter in the mail redirected from my publisher, from my academic publisher, not from this publisher, from the publisher of Use My Name. And as soon as I opened it, there was an airmail letter inside with the blue and red stripes around the edge. It said Carolyn Cassidy on the return address. And I knew immediately who it was. And I opened the letter and she was like, I loved your book, Use My Name. because of the following reasons. And Carolyn was very opinionated because she had known and been in love with Kerouac and Cassidy. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie that they made about it, starring Sissy Spacek, John Hurd, and Nick Nolte.
Yes, and what was the name of the movie?
Heartbeat. It was the first Orion Pictures movie, and it's a very interesting film. Anyway, Carolyn's sort of very possessive about the way people treated the people that she knew personally, and she liked the way I approached things. My approach was not to romanticize what was often some very, very poor behavior on the part of these men. We started exchanging letters by snail mail, which I kept. And then a couple of years ago, I was in Salt Lake City and I was talking to my publisher, my old friend from Naropa, Andy Hoffman, who has a press called Elick Press. And he said, "You got to publish these letters." And I said, "No, you've got to publish these letters." And so I wrote some continuity, an introduction explaining what I just explained to you about how it all happened.
And Carolyn was fine with having these letters published.
Well, she had just died.
Oh.
So that sort of set me thinking about, because that finalized the correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
So this came out 2 years after she died.
It's fabulous to know that you have offered these pieces of history. There are so many people alive who love the Beat Poets and that whole generation of what they thought and did. So what a contribution. Whether it became mass market or not, it's very, very valuable.
Right.
So I want to personally thank you for writing them. And somehow, with all your publishing and professorship responsibilities, you were also having a press.
I started a poetry press in 1990. Because I wanted to publish the poetry of an old friend of mine from my hometown, a guy named Ron Schaefer, who was a high school teacher in Decatur, Illinois. And he influenced many, many students for about 40 years. He was a really great guy. And he was a good poet and a nature lover, lived on a farm outside of town. I just basically started a press to publish him, but then other things started happening. I ended up publishing 7 or 8 books, I can't remember exactly now, one of which was by one of my Naropa buddies, Steve Creason, who, by the way, is a Northwest poet, even though he lives in Salt Lake City now. He grew up in Auburn, and he lived in Seattle for many years. And in the 70s and 80s and 90s, he was part of the Red Sky poetry scene. So he knew Roberto Valenza and people like that, Jesse Bernstein, the punk poets of that era.
So let's spell his name for people. Creason is C-R-E-S-O-N. And the name of the little book is Steve Creason Now Poems.
Right.
And why is he in Salt Lake? Is he teaching there?
He moved down there because my publisher, Andy Hoffman, and he are best friends, and they ended up living across the street from each other in the 9th and 9th neighborhood, which is a hip part of Salt Lake City. There's a huge poetry and art scene in Salt Lake City because of the university and just because it's a big city.
Because
too.
Those guys live there.
Because they live there. Yeah. It's like every cultural scene. It's led by real human beings.
Have we mentioned the name of your press?
The poetry press I had in Missouri was called Church of the Head Press, and there's a story behind that if you want to hear it. But my new press is called J. Jones Imprimatur.
Okay, let's hear the stories behind them both, and then let's hear some of what you've published.
I used to spend a lot of time in the Caribbean, in Jamaica in the 70s. One time I was in Negril, way out on the end of the island of Jamaica, and I was walking down the beach, and I met a guy carrying a seagull by the legs. He was carrying the seagull like it was a satchel, and the seagull was upside down. So I struck up a conversation with him, like, what are you going to do with that seagull? He basically just flipped it up in the air and the seagull flew away. And that led to this conversation about the fact that it was Sunday and we were both walking on the beach, he with the seagull. And he said, "Do you go to church, man?" And I said, "Well, I used to go to church a lot." And I said, "Do you go to church?" And he said, "I am in church, man. My church is the Church of the Head." So
that stuck
in my head, so I took that as the name of my press.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, Sheila is speaking with Seattle letterpress printer, author, and poet Jim Jones about his writing, time working with Allen Ginsberg, and his writings about Jack Kerouac.
I want to move on to how you named your next press, but how does one catch a seagull, let alone carry it like a satchel?
I didn't even bother to ask him. I was so taken aback by the fact that he had a seagull by the legs.
He had a technique, I guess.
Yeah.
The press that you do now for Poetry Postcards is something you started once you were in Seattle.
That's right. My inspiration came in the early 80s when I first started teaching. I had this colleague named Sid Berger who was teaching with me in the English department at Millikan University. And Sid had his own press, a nice little flatbed press that somebody in California had made for him. Sid eventually changed careers and became a rare books librarian on the East Coast. He's written many books about the history of bookmaking. But he had a press called the Doe Press. And in 1981, he was printing a book by Tom Gunn. And he was using really beautiful Japanese rice paper and binding it himself. And I just was really intrigued by the typesetting process. And the books he sold by subscription, he made 125 books and they were all sold before he ever finished the project. I thought, well, this is very interesting. And I was a journalist for a long time, too, so I was around sort of the end of the linotype era. It always stuck in the back of my mind that I would like to learn how to print. And so when I came to Seattle, I started looking around, and I found that there's a very famous printer from L.A. who moved up to Seattle about 20 years ago, Bonnie Thompson Norman, who has an open studio. And so if you want to learn how to print, you can just go every Wednesday night. You think up a project and she'll show you how to do it. So I studied with Bonnie for 5 years. And then by another connection through Sharon, my wife, I ended up getting my own press. And so then I had to acquire all of the type and the equipment and all of that. I call it Legos for adults because it's got so many little bits and pieces. For about 2 years, I've been printing my own postcards.
Say the name of what you call this press.
J. Jones Imprimatur. Imprimatur is an old Roman Catholic term for let it be printed. So in the old days when the church controlled everything in Western Europe, you had to have permission from the bishop in your diocese to print anything. If it had the imprimatur on it, it meant you were good to go. And
right.
So that's sort of a bow to my having been raised a Roman Catholic.
But it also makes sense today. We can make these decisions ourselves.
That's exactly right. And so I sort of co-opted that for my own business.
So in front of us on the table, you have quite a few of the postcards you've printed. And I'd love to hear some of the poems on there.
Another weird connection I made that wasn't through Sharon for a change was because one of the things I've done since I've been in Seattle is I belong to the Book Club of Washington, which is a book collectors organization. And for 2.5 years, I edited their journal. I brought a copy of it here with a picture of Tess Gallagher done by Alfredo Arreguin. Because of a mistake I made in an article, not written by me, but by someone else, there were two pictures in an article about a book collector who just died, a guy named John Henrik in Seattle, who was a famous collector of Northwest poetry. There were two pictures in there which I identified as his wife. One was a picture of Madeline DeFries, and the other was a picture of Tess Gallagher. So I published this with an errata slip in it. John's wife gave it to Tess, and I got a handwritten note from Tess Gallagher saying, "Who wouldn't want to be identified as the wife of John Henrik?"
How gracious.
So I wrote back to her, and it started a correspondence, and then we became friends because Tess and I were at Iowa at the same time. I've lived in Ireland. She has a house in Ireland. So we had a lot in common. She let me publish this poem. It's from her famous book called Portable Kisses, called Little Invitation in a Hushed Voice. Even birds help each other. Come close, closer. Help me kiss you. The other thing Tess has done for me is let me publish the poetry of her husband, Raymond Carver. Every year I make a holiday card, and last year I used the poem that's on his tombstone out in Port Angeles, Last Fragment, so that's been very nice. Also, Tess introduced me to some other poets that allowed me to print their work, one of whom is a Romanian poet she translates named Liliana Ursu, and this is one of Liliana's poems called From the Angel's Window. Sweet hay, raw grass, the hot udder, wild strawberries, a green corridor, pine pitch, the cathedral. From time to time an apple drops, a baptism. Through the art gallery, the girl walks by in mauve. You skate on a frozen tear, da capo. When I was in graduate school, we used to joke about our parties. We would allow friends of friends, but not friends of friends of friends. But I don't even limit that in my connections in poetry. The friends of friends of friends are fine, too. Anyway, here's a poem by someone that Sharon introduced me to called The Daughter Walk for Catherine Kent. We live on a circle, our mother's house is just to the west of our own. We carry casseroles to them, newspapers, printouts of family email, prunes to stew, brooms to sweep out corners. Our feet crunch over their crushed gravel driveways as the sun rises behind us, sets in front of our eyes. By Sheila Bender.
Thank you, Jim. It's awfully wonderful to hear someone else read a poem that you've written.
I totally agree. I think that's a lot of fun. That's why I wanted to do it.
Well, thank you. And also, to put me in a series with such established and wonderful poets is a great honor. I'm so impressed with how you just sort of allow in what's around you in terms of people and their connections and where you've placed yourself and your interests, and how it all seems to have flowed quite naturally.
Mm-hmm. The old Chinese Wu Wei, you know, just go with the flow. But I decided years ago that if something was too hard, it probably meant that you weren't meant to do it.
So that's very philosophical of you. And you did that as a young person? You figured that out?
When I was in the seminary, it was so intense. When I was in high school, it was so demanding. We went to school 6 days a week, and when we weren't in school, we were in church. When I left, I decided I never wanted to work that hard again. So I didn't.
Even though you had fun working.
Exactly.
It sounds to me like there's hard work in printing, there's hard work in everything, but the hardness is towards an end that's fun for you.
Well, yeah. Mark Twain said intellectual work is not really work because it occupies you to the fullest.
So you agree with him?
Yeah, totally.
What else would you like to tell us? We have all these wonderful books displayed here in front of me and postcards and lively conversation about your time with the Beats.
I started making these postcards because when I was working at Wessel and Lieberman a lot, Mark Wessel and Michael Lieberman were very big supporters of the poetry scene in the Northwest.
So I think we should stop and say that they ran that bookstore in
Pioneer Square in Seattle for 20 years, and it just closed about 3 years ago.
And it was all rare books?
Not all rare books, but mostly rare books. And also fine press books, which basically gave me access to a lot of finely printed books. So it really encouraged me as I was learning to be a letterpress printer to have access to, things printed by Jules Fay up in Cedro Woolley or by the C-Pen Press in Seattle or by other fabulous fine press printers in the Northwest. We had a lot of broadsides there, and they were hard to store. You had to have a map case, basically, to store these broadsides. They were hard to display. They were easily damaged, and it was difficult for people to figure out what to do with them. So I thought, when I start printing, I'm not going to make broadsides, although I have made a few. But I decided poetry postcards would be a lot better because, one, there's a great tradition of poetry postcards. When I was writing about the Beats, I collected a lot of stuff because it was so hard to find, small presses and whatnot. I had a poetry postcard by Gary Snyder that I really treasured. And I thought, well, let me make postcards because they're easier to handle. It's fun to get them in the mail because most of the stuff you get in the mail is junk. So it's nice to have something with content. It's good for people who are not used to reading poetry because it's small, like the Tess Gallagher poems, only a few lines long, and you can get it without a big struggle. And then what really clinched it was when my friend Joseph Venker gave me on permanent loan his tabletop pilot press. and I restored it, the platen is so small that I really can't print anything much bigger than a postcard with any facility. I mean, I can with some monkeying around, but the postcard is a really perfect size for this little press that I have. So that's the reason I started doing the poetry.
How many have you printed to date?
I've printed about 20, but I don't just do poetry postcards. I do some occasional things, too. Like, I printed this for the Book Club of Washington event that they had. I printed a wedding invitation for someone.
Which is a poem, though.
By Robert Frost. I printed my own humanist manifesto.
How would you like to read from your manifesto? You're such an interesting person. I think it would be fabulous to hear.
There's nothing better than reading your manifesto on the radio. The Humanist Manifesto. I don't know if I have time to do the whole thing. We assert that the highest priority in life is the individual and collective happiness of all humans. Therefore, we expect every government to protect the health, well-being, and liberty of its citizens, leaving the pursuit of happiness to themselves. Because no freedom can exist without informed choice, we call upon all governments to educate their citizens about the many varied options in life. Without deifying materialism, we trust science to inform public policy as we rely on compassion to administer it. Without sanctioning intolerance, we call for the legal suppression of all sexual, ethnic, and religious prejudice. Far from denying the need for cooperation, we nevertheless mistrust politics, and while accepting the possibility of transcendence, we also distrust religions. Let empiricism be our philosophy and humility our creed, preserving us from pretentiousness, and may daily practice lead us to make fine art, to play good music, and to write a fine hand.
Oh, thank you for reading that. Everybody should not only receive that postcard, but send it on around the world.
Well, I've got plenty.
Well, good. So how do people get in touch with you to get that postcard?
Shall I give them my email address?
Sure.
It's jjinchina2001@yahoo.com, and I'll be glad to send you one.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm just stunned with how appropriate that is for us. Thank you so much for being here today with us.
I loved it. Thank you, Sheila, for inviting me.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.